The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
So the question is, what's our priority, right? And ultimately, policy is all about priorities and trade-offs. And so the trade-off that President Obama chose to make was that Iran's nuclear program, it's the increasing sophistication and capability of its nuclear program would get it to weapons capability soon, in a way that would threaten its neighbors, threaten Europe, potentially threaten the United States, because it was also developing long-range missiles, and therefore was an urgent, and because we're talking about nuclear weapons, existential threat to us and our friends.
I'm Michaela Fogel, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, November 30th, 2019. Last month, Tamara Kaufman-Wittes, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs, and Brian Egan, former legal advisor to the State Department and National Security Council, participated in the Ambassador J. Christopher Stevens Memorial Lecture at the University of California Hastings Law School. Ambassador Stevens, who died tragically in the attack against the U.S. Special Mission in Benghazi, Libya, in 2012, was a proud alumnus of UC Hastings. In his memory, his family generously endowed an annual lecture on a current topic in foreign relations. This year's event featured a panel discussion with Kaufman, Wittes, and Egan, moderated by Professor Shimen Keitner on U.S. law and policy in the Middle East. The conversation takes a step back from current events to look at the broader strategic landscape following the U.S. withdrawal from Syria. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 478, Tamara Kaufman-Wittes and Brian Egan on law, policy, and the U.S. role in the Middle East.
What I want to start with, I suppose, is what's been in the headlines the most recently, which is the very recent implementation of a long-discussed decision to pull U.S. troops out of northern Syria. And so, Tamara, you're here to provide your regional expertise and insight, and I can think of no one better to try to at least give us the broad outlines of what's obviously a very complex situation there.
Sure. Shimen, thank you. And let me first say to the Stevens family, thank you for this opportunity. It's an honor to be here to memorialize Chris. I worked with him all too briefly when I was in NEA, but I bring with me the love and respect of the whole NEA family who miss him every day. He was tremendously admired, and I had the privilege of being a part of that NEA family for a brief period of time, but I'm also the daughter of a Foreign Service officer, and what you have done in institutionalizing the commitment that he represented to dialogue between Americans and the peoples of the Middle East is something that I admire tremendously, so thank you. I think the situation we face in Syria today is a horrific outcome of a series of unresolved dilemmas in American policy that stretch back to the early days of the Syrian civil war. President Obama, while he certainly believed that Bashar Assad's violence against his own peaceful protesters violated norms, delegitimized him as a leader of the Syrian people, and he sympathized with the Syrian people's desire for freedom from that dictatorship. That was not a project in which he was willing to commit American blood and treasure. And when President Obama finally was willing to commit American forces to the field in Syria, it was for a very narrow purpose, which was counterterrorism in the face of the reemergence of ISIS, of the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. And so we had a presence there that was inevitably interacting with this horrific civil conflict, but not attempting to shape it. We ultimately settled on, as our partners in the counterterrorism project in Syria, this Kurdish-led force in the northeast that our Turkish allies had serious problems with because they saw the Kurds as tightly connected to a Turkish-Kurdish terrorist group that was engaged in cross-border attacks as well as attacks inside Turkey. So the Turks never accepted that our engagement in Syria was going to have the effect of empowering and creating an autonomous zone functionally for this Kurdish-led group. President Obama's administration, I think, attempted to negotiate with the Turks for quite a long time about how these dilemmas might be resolved, but never came to any conclusions. President Trump's administration, I think, tried the same. Ambassador Jim Jeffrey, who was up testifying before Congress today, worked very hard to try and come to terms with the Turks about arrangements along their shared border with Syria. And ultimately, President Trump, who has long wanted to pull these troops out, decided to go ahead and do it without any arrangements in place to secure the counterterrorism gains that we and the Kurds fought for 5 years, along with help from European and Australian and other allies, without any arrangements in place to protect the civilians in this zone that had been autonomous from the control of Bashar al-Assad in Damascus, and without even any assurances from the Turks that whatever operations they were intending to undertake to secure their own border wouldn't end up occupying Syrian territory. President Trump did not care to check any of those boxes. And the result is that we now have a Turkish military incursion into Syria, and all of the harms that we might have hoped to avoid or at least mitigate, we are seeing in full flower.
So on that optimistic note, I'm going to turn to Brian in a minute for a legal analysis. But before I do that, I think, you know, one of the themes that we're going to return to throughout this conversation is the broader geopolitical context in which this is all happening, and one of the many foreseen and foreseeable consequences, as Tamara mentioned, of the U.S. withdrawal has been Russian troops moving in, as folks have seen in the media, literally to the very posts that U.S. soldiers were stationed at, less than a few weeks ago. But before we do that, I'm the fact that this decision was made and that troops are now, you know, withdrawn and withdrawing across the border to Iraq, many of them, it seems, at the moment, contrary to, as we understand it anyway, from the outside, the advice of folks, certainly on the Hill there was quite a reaction, but even within the administration, is there anything you can share with the group here about what that tells you in terms of the current state of national security decision-making?
I think we see both in this situation and also in what is coming to light about U.S.-Ukrainian relations over the last year or so, we see that there's been a complete breakdown of the normal national security decision-making process, whereby relevant agencies with interests in these relationships, with resources to put on the table on behalf of American interests, get together around a table, starting at the working level and going up, and prepare options for the president and work through the potential consequences of different options and cost them out, and then give the president an informed set of considerations on the basis of which to make his or her decision. And what we have instead is there is some working level interagency coordination, but by and large, the president seems to be making decisions in the absence of that kind of consultation and information, even from his national security advisor, even from his defense secretary. And that is worrisome no matter what the policy instincts or proclivities of that president might be, because the whole infrastructure is there because no one person can know everything they need to know to make good decisions for the United States of America. And it's there to test things out and give better information, better analysis, so you can make the best decisions possible. And I don't know any other conclusion to come to seeing the breakdown of this process than that we are not getting the best decisions we could get from this.
So, Brian, yeah, I'd love to turn to you, and in particular, to discuss the legal framework, which, again, in ordinary times is one of the major inputs to decisions like this, both the legal framework under which U.S. troops were there to begin with, which, of course, predated this administration, and what you see as the legal constraints or inputs, if any, into the current situation.
Sure. Thanks very much, Shimon, and thanks as well to the Stevens family for allowing me to participate. And I want to express my admiration, too, for the work of Ambassador Stevens, who's someone I got to know a bit when I was at the State Department and the NSC as well. His legacy is one that really does live on and will live on for many years. Courage, persistence, someone who was a lawyer by training as well as a diplomat. I think those skills really are invaluable, and we need to keep those skills in the U.S. system. And as an alumni myself of a school that many call the UC Hastings of the East Bay, it's really good to be here, back here at a place which I know was dear to Ambassador Stevens. I actually want to start on the process point that you raised a minute ago, which is, and I agree completely with Tamara, that it appears that our president right now really just has no use for process, the process that for 60 years has been something that every president has followed, which is a national security decision-making process that is founded in the National Security Council and the National Security Council staff, working up decisions with options to the president. And as when I was in the administration, last administration, I was part of that process on the legal side, but there's a huge policy component and operational component to that process as well. And it's interesting because I think one of the criticisms in the last administration was we had too much process, that decisions were too slow, they were over-lawyered, they were bogged down by bureaucratics, the NSC was too large, and I think that many on the other side said we need to make a change. And I think a clear change has been made, and I would just ask, you know, which is the preferable choice? And maybe it's neither. Maybe it's something in the middle. But there, you know, I don't think we have settled on the perfect process yet. As an international lawyer, I see international law everywhere. So I suspect some of you are similar. Some of you are probably skeptics. Some of you may not know much about international law. But in the Syria conflict, I know that international law kind of underpins many of the U.S. decisions. It didn't necessarily drive the decisions, but it was relevant to the U.S. decision-making process. And I'll just say a few words about that. So we talk about the use of force and the use of U.S. military troops in Syria. When you think about the U.S. or any country entering another country, as the U.S. has with Syria, it is a big deal as a diplomatic matter, as a policy matter, and as a legal matter. You look to the UN Charter as the basis for how we decide the use of force in other countries' territories appropriate. And there are a couple of grounds that many of you are familiar with. One is self-defense. Another is when a UN Security Council resolution authorizes the use of force in another country's territory. And a third is when the government of the country consents to your entering their territory. And so in the first part of the Obama administration when the Assad regime was committing the atrocities that Tamara mentioned, I think one of the issues that President Obama and others struggled with, in addition to the policy issues and the serious consequences from the policy side of invading another country, essentially was the legal issue. Responding to atrocities, while I think many would agree there are good, compelling reasons to do it, doesn't fit neatly within self-defense. It doesn't fit neatly. There was no UN Security Council resolution. The Russians and the Chinese were never going to agree, particularly the Russians, to allow the United States or others to enter Syria. So they vetoed multiple UN resolutions. And obviously, the Assad regime would not consent to the United States doing this. So there was a legal underpinning to struggles with using force in Syria that I think is an important aspect of how we think about the issues. Why were the U.S. troops there? Well, it was in the collective self-defense of Iraq, which was being attacked by the Islamic State, and in the national self-defense of the United States. And one interesting aspect of what's going on now to me as a lawyer is, if President Trump really believed, as he says, that ISIS had been defeated, then he may not have a legal basis to be in Syria anymore. Right. Now, clearly, many of his advisors disagreed with him, including his military advisors. But as a legal matter, once the ISIS threat is gone, there's no longer a self-defense justification for the United States to continue to place troops in Syria without the consent of the Syrian regime.
You know, Brian, this came up just today because of Ambassador Jeffrey's testimony. He's been before the Senate and the House over the last 2 days trying to explain this administration decision and explain, given that our troops are departing Syria, well, what is our policy towards Syria and what is it we're trying to achieve? And he laid out a set of policy aims that one of which is, you know, preventing the reconstitution of ISIS. So that goes to self-defense. It also goes to the authorization for the use of military force that was passed by Congress in 2002, and that is the U.S. legal justification for our troop presence in Syria. But he also laid out a whole bunch of other policy aims that have no basis in international law or American domestic law that I can think of. Tell me if I'm wrong. including protecting Syria's oil resources from being exploited by unnamed others, who might be ISIS, might be Iran, but the Syrian government presumably has sovereignty and the ability to use its oil resources as it sees fit, to contain Iranian influence in the region, he mentioned as an American policy aim, which I don't think we've ever used in the Middle East before as a reason to go ahead and invade another country. So, you know, I think we're still in a place where our policy bark is much bigger than our legal bite, if you will. And I would say even in policy terms, we're laying out a set of aims that we are not applying resources in a way that we could ever achieve.
Yeah, it is interesting that I think even when the troops were sent to Syria in 2015, there were many on the policy side in the last administration who were kind of hoping that this would be a bootstrap into a broader mission than the one that they were sent in there to achieve. So it is an interesting context that I think as lawyers and law students, it's important to kind of, I would suggest keeping that in mind as you read the media stories about what's happening right now.
Well, and I think your colloquy also really highlights the two layers, at least, of law that we're dealing with here, right? Or Brian started off talking about the United Nations Charter, which was, as many of you know, negotiated and signed here in San Francisco, just a couple blocks away in the War Veterans Memorial Auditorium. So that's an exciting bit of, you know, San Francisco trivia. But then a lot of the domestic discussion, anyway, does have to do with congressional authorization for the use of force, the extent to which the 2001-2002 authorizations, you know, permitted, as they've been interpreted to do, actions vis-a-vis associated forces of Al-Qaeda, which we've construed to include a very different group, ISIS. And in fact, those of you who remember both in 2017 and 2018, when the Trump administration actually carried out some bombing raids in Syria explicitly in response to the Assad regime's use of chemical weapons. The Office of Legal Counsel opinion that came out somewhat after the 2017 really focused just on this domestic law question of, you know, does the executive branch have authority to do this or not? So these are sort of two parallel tracks or parallel analyses in a way. And I think a lot of our allies and partners, of course, look at the international law side of things. But domestically, anyway, the political hot button has seemed to be the constitutional authorization.
Absolutely. And I think, too, that there's been a long dodge in Congress in terms of domestic legal authorization for what we're doing in Syria, because they had these old AUMFs from 2001 and 2002, and the Obama administration decided to use them as the basis to go into Syria after ISIS. And Brian's exactly right. Not only within the administration, but also on the Hill, there were those who wanted a broader range of policy objectives for the American presence in Syria. And so they sort of let this AUMF be the umbrella under which they could try to shove all this other, all these other ambitions. And Congress, the Obama administration was never explicit with Congress about what its strategy was in Syria. And Congress never compelled itself to revisit the question of whether to generate a new authorization for the use of military force to deal with ISIS or to deal with other policy objectives. And so the result is, you know, today, in the wake of President Trump's decision, you have people on both sides of the political aisle, both people who want far broader aims in Syria and people who want much narrower aims in Syria, all of them arguing that the whole operation was misconceived from the get-go because it all relied on this 2002 AUMF. Whereas, in fact, through all that period of time, they were all dodging the question of whether they needed to have a debate about the 2002 AUMF.
Well, I think if we're going to maybe shift gears a little bit and look at congressional involvement in and concern about foreign policy and just to cards on the table, my goal here is for us to canvass a number of countries in the region and the U.S. role in those countries, and then, of course, save some time to open up to questions, because, of course, we could otherwise spend many hours talking about Syria. One of the issues, it seems to me, that the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and particular members have been very concerned about over the last several years is the humanitarian crisis in Yemen. And maybe I'll ask Brian to give us a little background there, because one of the concerns has not only been the toll that the Saudi-led operation is taking there, but also the provision of U.S. assistance to the Saudis, whether it's in the form of arms sales or intelligence support or other forms of assistance, which, of course, also presents both legal and policy questions. So maybe, Brian, could you let us know sort of what you think of our current situation there and how that has played out?
Yeah, so for several years, going back to the last administration, the United States has provided military support to Saudi Arabia, as Shemin said, in Saudi's ongoing fight in Yemen against the Houthi rebels. And the issue has arisen and it continues to arise to this day as to whether that's appropriate and maybe even lawful in light of the Saudis' performance in Yemen, where the critics of Saudi Arabia say they have no respect for the law of armed conflict, the law, the rules that apply when a country is engaged in the use of force. You have to be careful to avoid civilians. You have to avoid religious objects. You have to avoid most medical facilities. And Saudi Arabia's track record, according to its critics, and I think it's probably true as a matter of fact, is not good in those areas. And so from the very early days when the United States began providing intelligence support and military support to Saudi Arabia, there have been questions raised about whether the United States was somehow culpable, responsible for Saudi Arabia's activities in Yemen in light of Saudi's track record. And how does this actually come up in real life? A couple of different ways, in my experience at least. One is from Congress itself, where you have members of Congress and senior staff in Congress who really focus on both human rights and the U.S. being the model for the world in human rights from their perspective, and the appropriate use of U.S. military assistance overseas, where there's a balance between the Congress and the executive branch, where Congress has passed a couple of laws that give the president pretty wide discretion to provide military assistance to other countries, so long as it's done appropriately. And these laws, one is called the Arms Export Control Act, another is called the Foreign Assistance Act, give the president a pretty wide leash to decide what appropriate means. But the Foreign Assistance Act talks about human rights and not allowing assistance where there would be human rights abuses, essentially. And the Arms Export Control Act talks about the use of force by other countries consistent with the purposes of the United Nations, which, again, would not allow the use of force that's not done in a manner that complies with the law of armed conflict. So members of Congress would come to the last administration. I'm sure they're coming. We know they're coming to this administration to say, what's going on? Why are you allowing this to happen? What are you doing to stop this? And I can tell you from my experience that the United States spent a lot of time trying to work with the Saudis to improve their record, where the folks who were most sympathetic to the Saudi side would say they just don't have a lot of experience with these things. And we've got to just train them better. We've got to work with them better. It's not an intentional problem that they're causing. It's a lack of experience. They don't have the skills. People on the other side, of course, say that's nonsense. This is really a country that doesn't care about these issues. So in the United States, that's really one of the key ways it comes up, though, is through Capitol Hill, at least in my experience. I don't know, Tamara, if you...
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think it's certainly both the interest that is enshrined in legislation, but also the enforcement of those legal provisions about the requirement for the executive branch to monitor the way in which weapons it sells or gives to other countries are used, to make sure that they're not being used in ways that violate human rights. All of that is written into law. Congress, especially the authors of that legislation, take it very seriously, and they demand accountability from the executive branch. And what you've seen just over the last year is now twice, I believe, different houses of Congress have voted to suspend American military sales to Saudi Arabia because of this understanding in Congress that Saudi Arabia is insufficiently diligent about living up to the obligations we impose under our laws for how weapons we sell get used. And the policy counterargument that gets made here is an interesting one. It's not only that, well, the Saudis aren't experienced and we have to, you know, train them better and so on. It's also that, well, if we don't sell them the best stuff, the most precision-guided stuff that we have, then they will go off kilter even more. You know, how are they supposed to target precisely and avoid the school building and avoid the mosque if we don't give them our most sophisticated precision-guided munitions? And if we don't give them the intelligence to target those munitions appropriately? So in other words, the argument made by those who want to support the Saudi effort is, no, we have to do more for them. We have to give them more and better, and that will make them more respecting of human rights. And if we failed to do that, their failure to comply with the laws of armed conflict is on us. You know, but it's sort of, where does that argument end, right? You can take that to extremes. And I think that, you know, that continues to be a kind of tug of war, including on Capitol Hill, about how this war in Yemen proceeds. But Brian, am I right that the argument that the Saudis and Emiratis made in going into Yemen was a self-defense argument? Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. That Saudi Arabia in particular argued that the Houthis were capable and in some circumstances actually launching weapons from Yemen into Saudi Arabia, and that therefore what started as an incursion just in the Yemeni-Saudi border area essentially has grown into something much broader.
Right. And so, you know, going back to that point about the UN Charter and the right of countries to self-defense, You know, the argument made first by the Obama administration and then by the Trump administration is that we are supporting our partners in the region as they pursue self-defense against these Houthi militias in Yemen. And we are now having a ripe debate in Washington about to what extent should the United States be supporting the right of Saudis and Emiratis to self-defense? They are not treaty allies the way Turkey is, the way Great Britain is. They are security partners, but we're not obliged to support their self-defense. So if we don't like the way they're defending themselves, should we be going along with that? And that's the discussion we're having now.
Well, and I'd like to linger on different aspects of our relationship with Saudi Arabia, which obviously has also been a very pressing issue in recent years. And Tamara, as we follow each other on Twitter, and I noticed you had quite a strong reaction to the announcement that this year a U.S. delegation will be attending what's referred to as Davos in the Desert, which is a Saudi-sponsored economic conference. And can you explain to us a little bit why that announcement elicited such a reaction from you?
Yes. Okay. So what this conference really is an investment conference. The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is working hard to try and bring in foreign capital to invest in its domestic economy. It's an oil-dependent economy. That oil industry is owned by the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, by the government. And so it's what we call a rentier state. It's a state where the government gets its revenue not from taxing people primarily, but it pulls it out of the ground and then sort of sends it down in a patronage network to citizens. So it's got a very generous social welfare system funded by oil revenues and so on. But as the population grows, the costs of supporting that population of the government go up. The oil income remains constant, and so you need to diversify your economy. So that's what the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is trying to do. And it is trying to attract foreign investment at a moment when it's engaged in this horrific humanitarian nightmare of a conflict in Yemen, at a time when it is engaged in unprecedented repression of its own citizens, including imprisonment of bloggers, of poets, of women's activists. It has a domestic legal regime which is very, very far from the basic requirements of the Universal Declaration on Human Rights. And last year, notoriously, the agents of the Saudi government tricked a Saudi national who was living legally in the United States into visiting their consulate in Istanbul and murdered him there. And that is a crime under international law that has yet to be addressed. The Saudi government has yet to take full responsibility for that or to engage in any steps that would suggest that it's trying to prevent its agents from doing that again, to the contrary. And so last year, this investment conference was scheduled to be held a few weeks after the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, this Saudi journalist. And the U.S. government representation was yanked, thankfully. This year, the administration seems to be trying to signal that they are interested in business as usual with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And so the Secretary of the Treasury and Jared Kushner, the first son-in-law, are going to Riyadh for this conference. So yes, it elicited a strong reaction from me because I think if the United States government cannot hold accountable strong bilateral partners when they murder its own legal residents, then that is something that endangers every American who travels abroad. It's something that endangers every dissident who claims asylum and receives asylum in this country. And it's something that endangers every journalist. And I find that not only offensive to my sense of what this country should be doing and what it should stand for, but I find it highly deleterious to American interests internationally, not only with respect to Saudi Arabia, but globally. Sorry, that was long.
No apology needed. It's very persuasive. But Brian, one of the many things that makes me think about, and of course, you know, the murder of Jamal Khashoggi was, you know, a tragic event that, as you say, has not really had any sort of closure put on it in terms of accountability, and may never. I mean, what are the kinds of tools that the United States could lawfully use, Brian, if we wanted to try to get Saudi Arabia to take greater responsibility? I mean, I know before you went to the National Security Council, you spent a year at least at Treasury. So economic sanctions have become a favorite, maybe two favorite tool of the United States. This morning, one of the announcements President Trump made is that we are not imposing sanctions on Turkey after all, because we have a permanent ceasefire in Syria, to return to our earlier topic. So presumably some kind of sanctions might be on the table. I mean, what would you, if you were in the government trying to effectuate some of the goals that Tamara has laid out from a policy angle, what kind of input or advice would you provide?
Yeah. Well, it's kind of interesting to think about this from what the National Security Council perspective. This is the very type of issue that in many administrations would go to the president through the National Security Council, and he'd be presented, or she would be presented, with a list of options. Here's what happened. Here are the tools we have at our ready that we can deploy in response to what has happened. And that menu would almost inevitably include things from on the diplomatic side. You could pull your diplomatic, you could downgrade or actually stop having diplomatic relations with the relevant country. It's seen as a big deal diplomatically to, if we pulled our ambassador to Saudi Arabia, if we downgraded our embassy, there are many steps you could take to signal that you really disapprove diplomatically of what something that has happened. From a foreign assistance perspective, there are any number of steps you could take, again, to signal your discontent with another country in that scenario. Economic sanctions, as Shemin mentioned, is another thing that is becoming an increasingly favored tool of American foreign policy. It was certainly also true in the Obama administration. I'd say even more so in the Trump administration. You could impose an embargo if you thought something had really gone wrong. Stop all trade between the United States and the relevant country. You could put sanctions on the prime minister or the leader of the country, again, to show that you believe that he or she was responsible for what had happened. So there are many things. The intelligence side, you could think about in changing your intelligence posture, intelligence sharing. You could stop military cooperation in Yemen with this country. Many, many steps could be taken to express displeasure. What was done, at least from my vantage point, was very, very limited. The Treasury Department, I think, named a bunch of Saudi kind of lower-level officials to a sanctions list in a way that, I don't know, those in the sanctions community at least didn't see as particularly meaningful at all. There have been some, I think, conferences and other events, Tamara mentioned, in the immediate aftermath of the Khashoggi murder. The United States did pull its representation from some events, but it could have done far more in that respect as well. So there are many options that could be available.
You know, there's one that was raised to me by someone in the human rights community. I'm curious for your perspective on this, Brian. But, you know, part of what was egregious about Jamal's murder is that it took place in a Saudi consulate. So it implicates the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations. You're not supposed to kill people in your consulate, right? You're not actually supposed to use your diplomatic facilities or your diplomatic immunity or your diplomatic status in another country to engage in behavior that is not, you know, in comportment with the purposes of diplomatic representation. I don't know the exact language of the convention, but when the Russians did something very similar, which is they went after this Russian dissident who was a former intelligence agent who had gotten asylum in the United Kingdom. And they sent two agents into the UK and poisoned him and his daughter. And there was some involvement of the Russian embassy, I think, provided credentials to these guys, and someone in the embassy had helped facilitate their travel. And when this was discovered, not only the UK, but I think 60 countries, maybe not that many, a bunch of European countries, the UK and the United States, we all expelled Russian diplomats to retaliate for this abuse of diplomatic privileges. And so in the Saudi case, we have something far more egregious, which is the use of diplomatic cover and diplomatic facilities to murder someone on site and cover up the crime. And we didn't expel anybody.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable, and to say the least. I think the issue of the Saudis' use of their consulate, it was in Turkey. The Turks kind of got over the niceties of the fact that this happened in a consulate, and they were actually quite cooperative when the dust settled in providing evidence and other support to the United States. So I think that sometimes the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations does provide many protections for an embassy and other diplomatic facilities in another country. But they're not unlimited. And there are many tools, including under the Vienna Convention, that a country can use to retaliate or to respond to something that is as egregious as what happened in this case.
So I'm going to shift the geographic lens ever so slightly to a country that we haven't been at all shy about imposing sanctions on, which is, of course, Iran. one of the first things that the new administration did was denounce and then withdraw from one of the worst and most one-sided transactions the United States has ever entered into, and that, of course, is the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, otherwise known as the Iran deal. Brian, can you give us a little bit of the lay of the land of what that deal aspired to do and what it may or may not yet do in the absence of the United States? And then, of course, I'll ask Tamara for her thoughts following up on that.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if President Obama would have called the Iran nuclear deal the best deal ever or perfect,
the
deal of the century, yeah. Terms that our current president uses. But I think, in fact, he would not have said it was perfect, but it was actually, I think, the best deal that could have been had, in my view. So think back to 8 years ago, where the United States essentially caught Iran illegally attempting to start or further its military nuclear program. This was a step that really galvanized international support for sanctions and pressure on Iran to stop that activity. And it eventually culminated in a deal that is known as the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which had a couple of key components, I think, to all the parties to the deal. And just thinking about this in this day and age, that in 2015, the United States, Iran, China, Russia, the European Union all came together on a major international agreement. It's almost unthinkable right now, given where we are in the world. But this did happen. So what were the key components of this deal? One, of course, Iran agreed that it would have to stop its military nuclear program, which I think everybody, including the United States, believed was the key overarching short-term objective with Iran. We had many problems with Iran. We have had for many decades many problems with Iran, but the military nuclear program, I think everybody agreed, was the key problem that had to be stopped in the short term. Second was limits on enrichment, limits on Iran's access to uranium that were not forever limits. They were not zero limits. They were numeric limits, and they were for periods of years, and very complicated formulas for many different periods of years, involving many different types of uranium in some cases, many different centrifuges that help accelerate the enrichment process, but very complicated formulas on limiting enrichment and limiting access to uranium. Third was inspections and verification, where an international body, the International Atomic Energy Agency, was authorized by Iran to have significant access to Iranian nuclear facilities to monitor Iran's implementation of this deal. And in exchange, the West gave Iran sanctions relief. For the European Union, this meant relief from almost all sanctions that were not connected to other things like terrorism. For the United States, this relief was much more limited, though. We still, when this deal, the JCPOA, was in effect, we still basically had an embargo on trade with Iran. As a U.S. person, I was not allowed to conduct business with Iran, by and large, while this nuclear deal was in effect. But what it meant was we would not threaten Europeans, we would not threaten Chinese, Korean companies who want to resume doing business in Iran with sanctions on them. Those are, some people call those secondary sanctions. That was a key concession that the United States gave as part of this deal. It was controversial from the outset. Almost immediately, Congress thought this was not a tough enough deal, it was not a good enough deal, and they imposed a series of limitations and certifications of the United States moving forward, basically to certify every so often, 6 months, in many cases, that the deal remained in effect, that Iran was complying, and the deal remained within the U.S. national interest. So enter President Trump. He was kind of handed a vehicle to basically walk away from the deal. But that was kind of by design through Congress. And it's the way that it more or less approved of the deal or didn't disapprove of the deal. It required him to certify every 6 months that the deal remained in the United States national interests. So it's almost inevitable that at some point in time he was going to say, no, I can't certify that anymore. And he did.
And maybe just before we move to Tamara, can you clarify, so the nature of this deal, and we've been calling it a deal, we haven't been calling it a treaty for a reason, right? So can you just explain what the difference of that is and why that may or may not make a difference as to how easy, so to speak, it was for one administration to shift gears, having been handed this from a previous administration?
So, so from an international law perspective, an agreement or a treaty between two countries as a legally binding instrument that basically two states come together, they agree to be legally bound by what they're signing up to. And in the United States system, depending on what the United States is committing to, depending on the subject matter of that agreement, it may require the Senate to ratify the agreement through the treaty process in the United States before it can take effect. In this case, there was a very clear, it was clear that there was going to be zero chance that the U.S. Senate was going to ratify a treaty along the lines of what was realistically possible with Iran. And so the negotiators from the United States set about deliberately to make this deal, let's call it, not an agreement, not legally binding, something that was a political commitment, but that could be walked away from by the parties without breaching a treaty obligation. So there were elaborate procedures built into this deal that parties could use to walk away. Of course, the United States, when they walked away, just kind of blew through these procedures and just left the deal on the cutting room floor. But it was known from the outset, at least from the United States side, that this deal was not legally binding and therefore could be walked away from in the way that it was here.
So tomorrow, again, something we could talk about for hours, but what, in the context of this conversation, would you like to share with us about our, the Iran deal and or where we now stand in terms of our outreach and or shunning, depending on the day of that regime?
Sure. I mean, I think this is yet another one of the issues that we've been talking about this afternoon, where you see the layering of domestic American politics, executive legislative relations, domestic law, international law, and policy, right? And so, if Obama could have gotten 2/3 of the Senate to sign up to that deal, it would have been a treaty, and President Trump would have had a very hard time walking away from it. And it wasn't a treaty because he knew he wasn't going to be able to get 2/3 of the Senate, right? And that meant that at the end of the day, the Iranians had to be willing to sign a deal that they knew there was a chance that the next American president might oppose. And they were willing to sign up to it anyway. So as we think about where we are now and where we go from here, it's important to recognize that that sort of domestic game board, if you will, and the international game board, they're both going at the same time. And if you're the president of the United States, you have to look at both those game boards, but your international negotiating partners also are looking at both the domestic American and the international game board in making their assessments about the credibility of American commitments.
And that's one of the things that's always amazing to me, in a way, is how closely other countries follow domestic U.S. politics. And as you say, it's a necessity, really, in order to be able to anticipate what the result might be of any particular interaction.
Right. And, you know, in political science, one of the reasons that we hypothesize that democracies go to war with each other less than other kinds of governments is because we are transparent. Other countries can see what's going on in our domestic politics. And so if our president says something that surprises them, they can look inside our own politics and get a sense of why or where it's coming from, right, and understand it better. Or if he says, you know, I need this and that in order to gain domestic support, that's not just his sort of gestalt sense of what he needs his military council to approve, because he's not a dictator. That's something that they can verify through their own observations. So democracies have, it can be both an advantage and a disadvantage in international negotiations, that there's some transparency to our system. But it means that when we do make commitments, they come with a certain degree of reliability because the domestic basis for them, the domestic support for them, is easier for other countries to see. So when it comes to Iran, I think what's most important to understand is that the nuclear agreement, as Brian said, only dealt with one dimension of Iranian behavior that is problematic from the perspective of American national security interests. The Islamic Republic, the government of Iran since 1979, is a revolutionary regime that ideologically and practically seeks to export its revolution. That means that it works to subvert the politics of other states in the region. It does that through intelligence activities, covert funding. It does that through militias, and it does that through, you know, propaganda and politics. The Islamic Republic also supports international terrorist organizations, including terrorist organizations that target and kill and have killed Americans. And the Islamic Republic directly threatens the governments and friendly states to the United States, including Saudi Arabia and Israel, among others. So there's a range of different problems that we could set, you know, try to tackle in our engagement with the Iranians or in, you know, sanctioning the Iranians or what have you. And then, of course, there's the fact that they're an incredibly domestically repressive human rights abusing regime. So the question is, what's our priority, right? And ultimately, policy is all about priorities and trade-offs. And so the trade-off that President Obama chose to make was that Iran's nuclear program, it's the increasing sophistication and capability of its nuclear program would get it to weapons capability soon in a way that would threaten its neighbors, threaten Europe, potentially threaten the United States because it was also developing long-range missiles, and therefore was an urgent and, because we're talking about nuclear weapons, existential threat to us and our friends. And so he decided that was the most urgent priority in terms of U.S. relations with Iran. And he devoted immense resources, a lot of his foreign policy presidency, to sanctioning Iran to get it to the table, building the international coalition that made the negotiation of that deal possible, and getting to that deal, and then getting it through Congress. That was your job, right? The last year of the Obama administration. Now, that left a lot of other Iranian behavior relatively unaddressed, and that made a lot of our regional friends nervous and upset, because for some of them, not all of them, the nuclear program was not the most urgent threat. For the Israelis, it was certainly the most urgent threat, but for the Saudis and the other Gulf states, the nuclear program was not the most urgent threat. They wanted our help against domestic subversion, or everything they saw as domestic subversion. And so when we achieved this not perfect, but substantial nuclear agreement, it meant very little to those guys. They didn't feel any safer. And when President Trump campaigned on getting out of this deal and turning the screws on Iran, that was music to their ears. So now he's pulled out of the deal. He's ratcheted up the sanctions on Iran. The Iranian economy is suffering. The Iranian population is suffering as a result. The Iranian regime is responding in the way that it promised it would. It said, if we can't export oil, nobody else can either. And so it has engaged in attacks on oil shipping through the Persian Gulf. And at first, our partners in the Gulf, our Arab partners in the Gulf, were very happy to see this degree of American stout-heartedness and confrontation. But when the Iranians started actually engaging in attacks on shipping, they expected us to respond, to retaliate. And President Trump blinked. And, you know, I think that that experience for them has really, and then combine that with this sudden Syria withdrawal, has left them really wondering what path they can take to deal with the threats that they face from Iran. And I don't think that we yet in Washington have come up with an answer.
So I'm going to ask one more question, and then I'm going to open it up to the floor. I know some folks have to go to class, and we understand, and we're so glad you were able to join us. But my last, you know, moderator's question does involve, you know, the other, of course, well, there are many other important countries that we haven't had a chance to touch on, but I do want to spend a moment on Israel-Palestine. And in particular, I think that the Israel-Palestine, the issue I'm going to ask about, which is the decision to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel without, or somehow without prejudicing sovereignty issues and line drawing, but nonetheless moving our embassy there, I think it reflects a lot of the themes that you both have addressed. You know, one is sort of what are the legal parameters around the courses of action the United States can take? Another is policy process and how are decisions made and acted on? Another, of course, is relationship between foreign policy aims and domestic political audiences. And then the one maybe of most interest is the question of continuity or lack thereof from one administration to another, because, of course, in a democracy, when you're changing the executive every 4 years or every 8 years at least, it's, of course, very understandable that when the new team is in town, they're going to have different priorities, different approaches, and maybe they were even elected for that reason. But it does seem to create some lack of stability and also difficulty when you have, for example, one administration or even multiple successive administrations trying to put in place, in the case of Israel-Palestine, a set of frameworks for negotiation and carrots and sticks, and that can literally be sort of, you know, taken away in an instant. So maybe, Brian, you can talk a little bit about, you know, how you perceive that decision and its implications, and then tomorrow we can turn to you to sum up again just for the purpose of our conversation. And of course, in just a moment, if those of you have questions, I'll invite you to the microphones after we've heard from our two guests.
Sure, I'll be very brief on this one. So from my perspective, one very interesting aspect about the decision to move the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem is this is in fact something that the U.S. Congress has been pushing for decades. Even though president after president has said, we will not do this, we think the status of Jerusalem should be decided between the parties to the conflict, a law called the Jerusalem Embassy Act has tried to require presidents to move the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem for, I don't know how long
1996.
Now. Thank you. 23 years. And president after president issued a waiver that Congress reluctantly added to that law at kind of the last minute, where presidents have said, no, we have decided that it would not be the U.S. national security interest to do this, and made some other certifications and therefore declined this mandate from Congress. So it's somewhat ironic that President Trump made this very abrupt decision that has been very controversial, but including to members of Congress, when the very same members of Congress have had this law in place for 23 years, trying to require the president of the United States to do this. I don't think it necessarily justifies the president's decision or how he did it, but it's kind of an interesting aspect to this, again, as a lawyer that I think about when I see these things happen in real time.
Yeah, well, and one feature of that legislation is that it forbids the executive branch from spending any money on an embassy if it's not in Jerusalem. And so the result is that since 1996, our embassy, which was in Tel Aviv until recently, was growing increasingly decrepit, and nothing could be done to renovate it or fix it up because it was forbidden to spend new money. In fact, I think that provision may have predated the 1996 law because my father served at Embassy Tel Aviv beginning in 1987. And the building was decrepit then, I have to say. So I think this is one of those situations where there's the what decision did the administration make? And you can explain and understand the decision to move the embassy to the city that the State of Israel has always called its capital, to a part of the city, well, so at least our consulate in Jerusalem was in West Jerusalem in pre-1967 Israel. In other words, not over the Green Line, not in the West Bank. And so, you know, calling that the embassy would not necessarily be prejudicing the outcome of Israeli-Palestinian negotiations. But the how matters, right? Just like the Syria decision, how you do it matters at least as much as what you do, if not more. And what the Trump administration decided to do was, as Brian said, do this rather suddenly and not do it in the context of let's leverage this decision by the United States that has long been desired by the Israeli government. Let's leverage it on behalf of some concession, some progress back to the negotiating table. Nope, we're just going to do it. It's a gift. It's free. And so that's one how that I don't understand. The other part of the how that I don't understand is why it was done with no nod by the American government to the aspirations of Palestinians for a capital in East Jerusalem and the terms of reference of the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations, which we've sponsored all this time, that say that Jerusalem, the status of Jerusalem, is an issue for negotiation between Israelis and Palestinians, and that we're not going to prejudge that. So if we're going to move our embassy, could we at least do it in a way that makes clear that we understand there are two claims to the city and they are going to be subject to negotiation? And the Trump administration did not do that afterwards. In fact, they made the point after the decision of saying on the record that they did it to take Jerusalem off the table. So it did the opposite. It sent a message to the Palestinians that this American administration is not interested in their claims to Jerusalem and is not interested in that component of the negotiating framework that the U.S. sponsored beginning back in 1993. And so that, I think, sets us back. It sets back American policy. It sets back the American position in our ability to husband Israelis and Palestinians toward peace, which I don't realistically think we can do much of right now. But when and if the opportunity arises, we are not now well positioned to do it. And it also sets back the conflict itself, because by sending that signal to Palestinians, you are basically taking some hope away from a people that is already on the edge of out of hope. And when that happens, you are increasing the chances for conflict, which, you know, I don't think in any way absolves anyone of responsibility should they decide to engage in violence. But I think we have to, you know, I study conflict. It's what I do. Those dynamics are real, and you would be foolish to ignore them.
So who would like to introduce other questions into our conversation? And depending on how many we have, maybe we'll listen to input from the audience, and then we can come back to our speakers.
Hi. You know, of course, in response to what you just said, you know, President Trump doesn't do quid pro quos. Doesn't believe in them. So I also have, I got so many questions about Israel and the situation there, but the one I have, particularly in light of the discussion and the situation in Syria, Israel has, as we know, even publicly, consistently used military force against Iranian proxies in Syria, Lebanon, maybe even in Iraq, with the tacit approval of the Russians. So do you see any change in that prospect in light of essentially Russians taking control of the the Middle Eastern sphere. Oh. And I'd also love to hear your thoughts about whether Benny Gantz can make a get a good majority together, but we can do that later.
Tonight, I hope we'll hear from at least one or two students, because we really are here for you. So thanks so much for breaking the ice. Yeah. But any students you want to come up and put other issues on the table?
I'd love to hear an answer to your thought about the Russians.
I don't know, we will. We're going to come back. Don't worry. But I'm keeping my eye on the clock, so we want to get all these issues on the table first of all. Naomi, why don't you encourage folks around you to come to the mic as well, and in the meantime, we'd love to hear
come
your
to the
thoughts.
Mic. So I wanted to actually move away from a sort of regional focus for just a second to an institutional focus on the State Department, on the sort of U.S. government machinery that has been in place, as you said, for 60 years to deal with issues of foreign policy. And, you know, the last few years, there have been more and more alarms sounded about the destruction of the State Department, the, you know, inability of people who want to be career foreign service officers, who want to work in that sphere, to do so. And I'm wondering, especially for the young people here, how do we walk our way back from that? And is it possible to do so?
Thank you.
All right. Would you like to put something on the table, please?
My question was in regards to Syria and the detainee camps. You know that there are thousands
of detainees.
Yes. Well, specifically the ones that are the relatives that have thousands of women and children detained. And I know they're from about like 50 countries or so. And Australia has been dealing with it. I believe America has. And the lawyers of the women and the families are saying that the home countries owe these women due process. But a lot of the countries are shunning them and saying that it's a national security threat to go and try to bring them back. So I was just interested in your legal opinion on this matter.
Good one, Brian. Mm-hmm.
Did you also have something you wanted to add?
So I had a question largely also for Tamara. I was really interested in reading your bio about your forthcoming book and thinking about sort of who our autocrats are in the Middle East. And I also wanted to sort of probe a little bit, given the long documented history of human rights abuses in the occupied territories in Palestine, whether that book is going to address to what extent the Israeli government can also be considered one of our autocratic allies in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Great. So maybe to organize those a little bit, I'll invite you both first if you have anything that you would like to say in terms of the ISIS detainees and particularly detained family members of either ISIS members or affiliates in northern Syria and what's going to happen with them. And then we can move to the Israel discussion, autocracy, use of force, Russian role, and then end on the institutional question about the State Department.
Okay.
On the issue of the ISIS camps and the family members, women and children, and actually ISIS members as well, I think one policy position the United States has taken, I believe the current administration continues to take, is maybe not as a legal matter, but they say it, is they expect countries to repatriate their nationals. And I think that this is an issue that in part kind of stems from the fact that everyone has a state, everyone has a home, and if you're a national of the United States, for example, you get to come back to the United States. You may be imprisoned when you come back to the United States if you've committed a crime, but we can't keep you out of the United States if you're a U.S. national. And this has been an issue, I think, in particular for some of our European allies. They've really struggled with this issue. They don't want to take back ISIS fighters in particular. Family members are a slightly different story, but they have struggled with this idea of repatriation for several years. And I think it's an interesting issue. One question is, where do the detainees want to go? Do they want to go back to their home countries? Do they want to remain where they are? No. Do they want to go to a third country? Are they seeking asylum under international human rights laws? I think the key is that there has to be a framework that everybody that's transparent, that the relevant countries have kind of agreed to. And I think it can be based on these types of concepts that are based on international law. But to me, the kind of the fundamental part of that framework is you must be a national of some country. And if you're a national of that country, at minimum, that country is a place to which you must be able to be repatriated.
Tamara, maybe on some of the Israel questions.
Yeah, sure. So I'll start with the question of Israeli targeting of Iranian proxies and also Iranian forces in Syria and Iraq. This is activity that the Israelis began because of their concern about Hezbollah, which is an Iranian-supported militia and an organization that's engaged in terrorism, including international terrorism. It's a designated foreign terrorist organization under U.S. law. This is an organization that has been building up its guided missile capability. For a long, long time, it has had dumb rockets that it has been able to lob over the border from Lebanon into Israel. I have had the unpleasant experience of being out of doors when those dumb rockets have come over. It is not fun. But those were relatively small and did a relatively small amount of damage because they could not be aimed. Hezbollah has been working hard to upgrade its guided missile capability so that it can target Israeli airports, Israeli population centers, and shut down the Israeli economy. And its missile arsenal has grown substantially since the last major Israeli-Hezbollah conflict in 2006. The main conduit for that technology has been through Syria, and Israeli and American understanding is that there is a conduit from Iraq across Syria into Lebanon. And so Israel has been pretty intent on trying to prevent those transfers of weapons and weapons components and relevant expertise, and also pretty intent on trying to keep Hezbollah and Iranian forces away from the Israeli border with Syria. I think that, yes, they've coordinated quietly with the Russians on this ever since the Russians came into Syria in 2015, right? And the Russians have basically stayed out of the way. But that doesn't mean that the Russians will acquiesce to a lot of escalation. And so I think now, especially now that the United States is largely removing itself from the field and Russia and Turkey are basically splitting up spheres of influence inside Syria, the Israelis are going to have to figure out how much they can ask of the Russians, how much they can reasonably expect the Russians will be willing to do to accommodate their security interests. And that's before you get to the question of striking in Iraq, which I think is a very, very dicey move. It's something the Israelis have felt urgently necessary, but I think because they see cooperation between Iranian-sponsored militias in Iraq and Iranian-sponsored militias in Syria, but I don't know that it's sustainable. Very briefly to the question about autocratic allies, which is the subject of a book I am working on now. So I'm looking at these relationships that American administrations have had over time with specific leaders. So the book is really looking at Musharraf of Pakistan, Mubarak in Egypt, King Abdullah in Saudi Arabia, and Erdogan in Turkey. And looking at the way in which American administrations of both parties across time have engaged in a kind of wishful thinking or have told themselves stories about who these guys are and what we can achieve together. And I'm doing this because it tells me something about us, about the assumptions that we bring to our relationships around the world. Now, some of those assumptions are kind of idealistic. Some of them are bizarrely dysfunctional, but they're really persistent, and I find them fascinating. So I'm using these relationships with these autocrats as a way of telling a story about American foreign policy and America's approach to the world. All of that by way of explaining why these four. Okay, there are a lot of others I could potentially include. But when it comes to the specific question of do I consider the Israeli government to be an autocratic partner because it rules in occupation over the Palestinians living in the West Bank and effectively in Gaza. I don't. And let me explain why. Because from the 1967 war until now, so far, the Israeli government has accepted that it is in military occupation of territory and populations that were conquered in the 67 war. It accepts the Fourth Geneva Convention as the guiding international legal framework. Now, does it always, do its policies and actions in the West Bank and Gaza always accord with what you or I would interpret as its obligations under the Fourth Geneva Convention? Probably not. But it is in occupation of territory conquered in war and the populations who live there. The policies that the Israeli government produces and manifests, both for its own citizens and for those territories it occupies, are generated through a democratic political system. Now, one of the things I did over the last year was a piece of research looking at populist politics in Israel and polarization in Israel and whether Israel is in democratic decline, like a lot of other Western democracies. And while I found some danger signals, my conclusion is that Israel is still a democratic state. It's a democratic state with really strong identity politics and very intense political polarization. But if anything, despite the attempts by Netanyahu in the last months as he's fought his second electoral campaign inside of a year, despite attempts to put himself outside the law, to manipulate electoral rules to the advantage of his own party, and to remain in power well beyond his mandate, the voters more or less rejected those attempts. And so he's not going to get immunity from criminal prosecution. And now Benny Gantz, the leader of the main opposition party, has been tasked with forming the next government, which is the first time in a decade that that's happened. So, you know, yes, I can have a lot of concerns about Israeli policy in the West Bank and Gaza, about it, what Israel may do in the future with respect to its obligations under Fourth Geneva, because, you know, we're now, because of the Trump administration's action on the Golan Heights and recognizing the Golan Heights, we have a question about whether UN Security Council Resolution 242 still applies. So those questions are live. I'm not saying they're irrelevant, but just as I take a snapshot right now, that's where I come down.
And so, I mean, we're obviously going to have quite a lot to discuss also over drinks. But before we get there, Brian, I also am very eager to hear your thoughts to my colleague Naomi Rodariaz's question. You know, of course, tomorrow would have lots of thoughts too. I have thoughts, but, you know, why don't you walk us through a little bit what you would advise the students in the room to be thinking about in terms of, you know, following in your footsteps, tomorrow's footsteps, either in the immediate or slightly longer term future.
Yeah. I think that one administration can only have a limited impact long term on the makeup of the U.S. government. I really do believe that. And I think if you are interested in public service, if you're interested in foreign service, I would just so strongly encourage you not to abandon those interests, regardless of your political views. Maybe you're a strong supporter of the current administration. Maybe you're not. It doesn't matter. You should definitely follow in the footsteps of people like Ambassador Stevens. You know, people who are dedicated to the United States and the U.S. Constitution, regardless of party, and are courageous enough to bring those beliefs overseas, are going to be invaluable to our system. I think that's not going to change. I think as it is definitely disheartening to those at the State Department what's going on right now in the State Department and in our embassies, where I think there's a feeling, a conspiracy feeling, that the current administration is not only, you know, they're actively seeking to deplete the ranks of the State Department. They're happy to do it. And I think people are worried about that. But that's not going to be forever, and Congress doesn't agree with that. And this is another area where Congress has something to say.
Yes.
Congress, it's kind of the flip of the normal situation where the executive branch will ask for 100 widgets and Congress will give them 50. In this case, the state, you know, the executive branch is saying we only need 50 employees at the State Department, and the Congress says, well, we're going to give you 100 and we want you to fill those slots. So there is a battle going on right now about the makeup of the State Department and other agencies. If you're thinking about the Justice Department, I would say exactly the same thing. We need you. If you're thinking about the Federal Public Defender Service, we need you. Please don't stop thinking about it because of your feelings about what's going on in domestic politics right now.
I didn't think it would be possible to end tonight on a somewhat optimistic note, but I think you just managed. So with that, let me thank all of you, the Stevens family, our wonderful guests. Thank you so much.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to UC Hastings for providing this audio. If you have a second, please share the Lawfare Podcast on social media and give us a 5-star rating and review wherever you found us. You can now purchase Lawfare swag at our online store, www.thelawfarestore.com. The podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patia Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.